Okay, tell me something. Do you really like movies? But really, really like movies? When's the last time you went to see a movie in a theater? You know, a movie that you really thought meant something to you. I don't know. You know, I guess maybe it's just not my thing anymore.
I like making my own movies.
What do you mean you make your own movies?
I guess I'd like to keep some parts of my life private.
Nobody has a private life anymore, Tara.
All actors, are we?
Hi, everybody. It's Adam Shartoff, your host of FilmWax Radio, and you're listening to episode number 467 of the podcast. I hope this finds you well. This episode is a special episode. It's a little different than the typical episode. I've done some roundtables in the past, but I don't think I've ever done a roundtable specifically around a particular, on the subject of a particular filmmaker. I've done a couple of conversations in the past about a particular filmmaker with one other person. I did a conversation on Fred Wiseman with Teddy Kalatas some couple years ago. I did another conversation on Todd Solondz with journalist John Anderson a couple of years ago. But I've never done a roundtable, and I tell you what, I'll never do it again. Just kidding. This was a, you know, I was inspired somewhat by doing these roundtables around, you know, these auteurs, but I was also inspired by that. Well, I've already done them, as I said, in the past, but one-on-one, but so I was inspired to continue that. I really like that idea of once in a while just bringing someone on, or in this case, a few people on, and talking about, you know, a great filmmaker. But I was also inspired by what James Hancock is doing over at Wrong Reel and to some other podcasts that I listen to, where they really do a deep dive into either a film or into a filmmaker or into a year in film. You know, my show is an interview format show. However, you know, I like to occasionally break from it. And so I brought on three friends. We have Jeremy Workman, who's a filmmaker. Jeremy has been on the show a couple of times, but he's back and he has a new film also, as it turns out, that's premiering at South by Southwest this coming week. I'll be there for the premiere, and we'll have Jeremy back on yet again with the subject. The film he's got is called The World Before Your Feet, and he is going to be back on the podcast with a South by Southwest coverage, and he's going to be on with the subject of that documentary, Matt Green. But he's going to join us for this conversation about Paul Schrader, as will Chico Leo, who is out there in the podcast sphere. He's involved with the Fan Bros podcast, I believe, and a couple of others. And then we have James Hancock, who's the host of Wrong Reel. They'll be joining us in a second. This is a conversation about Paul Schrader, who started as a screenwriter very young. Before he started making his own films, he wrote The Yakuza, Taxi Driver, perhaps most famously Obsession, and Rolling Thunder, and then he started to direct with films like Blue Collar, Hardcore, American Gigolo, Cat People, and on and on. And he continued also to be a screenwriter for himself in the films I mentioned, but also, not all, sometimes he's just a director for hire as well. So he would go sort of around doing either writing screenplay like he or co-writing like he did with Raging Bull and The Mosquito Coast and a number of others, but he also directed some films he didn't write. So what you end up having is an amazing eclectic group of films that continues right up to today. He has a new film coming out shortly called First Reformed, and it's hopefully between the fact that that's coming out soon and this podcast, perhaps we'll get Paul Schrader on the show. You never know. That's the goal, or one of the goals. So let's get into it. This is a delightful filmmaker. A lot of his work is very available. I think, you know, in the show description, we'll try to figure out how to make that information available to you, how you can find them. But anybody who's really into film can find most of his films, at least on DVD, if not on some streaming service or other like Amazon Prime or iTunes. But in the meantime, let's right now go into this conversation with, again, Jeremy Workman, James Hancock, Chico Leo, and your host, Adam Shartoff, on the subject of Paul Schrader, here, only, on FilmWax Radio.
This is Greta Gerwig, and you're listening to Film Wax Radio.
Second call, 404 Hamilton, 417. 1-9-5, now final, 448.
De Niro. In Bang the Drum Slowly, the critics called him a brilliant new talent. After Mean Streets, they said he was a genius. For his performance in The Godfather Part II, they gave him the Academy Award.
Come on, man. Just get me out of here, all right?
Now, Robert De Niro creates a terrifying portrait of life on the edge of madness.
Tabby, just forget about this. It's nothing.
Taxi Driver, a film by Martin Scorsese.
Yeah, people do anything in front of a taxi driver. I mean anything. People too cheap to rent a hotel room.
Oh, driver, hurry up, will you?
People want to embarrass you. It's like you're not even there. It's like, you know, like a taxi driver doesn't even exist.
This city here is like an open sewer, you know? It's full of filth and scum.
I think I know what you mean, Travis. But it's not going to be easy.
When you guys get to be a Secret Service man?
What?
I was just curious because I thought maybe I'd make a good one.
Have you seen Forever Mine?
I watched 2/3 of that.
Is it good?
We'll
get to it.
We'll have to. It's your host, Adam Shartoff, here on FilmWax Radio. We're in the Central Village, I guess you'd call it, here at the home of James Hancock, the host of Wrong Reel, who is I'm now officially introducing as one of the four participants today in this conversation. Hi, James.
Hello.
Okay. I always expected the Picard reference, but
the podcast where we cover everything from Jean-Luc to Jean-Luc Picard.
Yeah, I love that.
Well, yeah, I'm just thrilled to have you guys here in my home recording an episode of FilmWax Radio. I just will have to remember I can't step on top of everybody and interrupt people constantly because it is no longer my show. This is your show.
And you have to talk slower for the old folks.
I'm sorry, we got enough scotch here that so we'll be talking really slowly for a half hour.
And then you'll start hearing the unmistakable sound of a middle-aged man snoring.
As long as you do it in the voice of James Mason, I feel like we're good to go.
Not a problem, young man, at all, yes.
That was more Michael York, but you also heard just now Chico Leo, who is here with us today.
That's right. So, hi, I have been on a couple of episodes of The Wrong Reel, and things have gotten very exciting. So we're going to have to, I think the scotch is a good thing. Hi, I'm Chico Leo. You might know me from Fan Bros or Scream Squad. Currently, Scream Squad is on hiatus because I have to get a new computer. And this is the woes of a podcaster.
I know, you're right. Having come off of a Kickstarter, I drank the Kool-Aid, Chico. I'm just saying, you know, there's no shame in asking listeners to kick in. If all the listeners just kicked in like a few bucks, you'd have probably take yourself on a Tahiti vacation as well.
That's right. And I would hope that it would be like a Tahiti vacation like the one that Marlon Brando had while he was making the remake of
Bounty.
Yeah, Mutiny on the Bounty.
Also, it's great with feature films. It's almost like you're pre-selling movies now to the audience as opposed to pre-selling to distributors where you say, hey, for $5-$10, you get a free download of the movie, which is basically you're just selling the movie and then you're going out and making it. And like this movie up here on the wall, we used Kickstarter for like half the budget. So
You're making a reference to
Bill Plimpton.
FilmWax frequent guest Bill Plimpton.
He's been on like 3 times, hasn't he?
He has, yeah. Which now, I guess, this is your second visit on my show, right? No, this is the first time. Welcome. I'm sorry. Welcome to both
virgin.
James and Chico.
We're all virgins.
Not me.
So that's everybody. Do you hear me?
You're not a virgin?
No.
And of course, I say certainly not the worst for last. my friend. That was awful. Let me rephrase. My good friend and great friend of the podcast, Jeremy Workman.
Thanks for having me.
And may I say friend of many podcasts.
I have done Wrong Reels. Yep. We've done that three or four times.
And I introduced you to those nut jobs.
The Grand Boof crowd. Booth. Uh-huh. Those guys are fun. And I've done a couple Film Wax podcasts as well with you, which have always been a really, really good time. So it's fun to sort of now bring everybody together.
So today's, welcome everybody. And thanks for joining me today. And one thing is, right before we go into our conversation, which by now most people probably know, is a conversation on the career of Paul Schrader, screenwriter, director,
legend,
very true, yeah,
Calvinist,
and we'll say former
recovering Calvinist,
very good. Before we get to that, I just wanted to make sure we got in now. If anybody has any new stuff going on that we want to mention. Chico, you talked about your podcast. It's on temporary hiatus. We're going to all fix that. Anything else going on worth mentioning?
Oh my God! Yeah, that's pretty much the big news, at least in the public podcasting world.
Why don't you could co-host my podcast?
You can come on Wrong Reel anytime you feel. Sure.
All right. Yeah, that's what I'm gonna have to do. I'm gonna Ronin. I'm a man without a home right now.
If you're gonna have to get a lot of scotch.
Because I don't know if people out there actually realize that sometimes podcasts are recorded live and in person, but often they're recorded over the internet, where people are not in the same room but looking at each other over the computer. Super high tech,
right?
And if you bought your computer in 2009, it's possible that your operating system won't allow you to do that anymore.
Yeah, I just did the Criterion Now podcast, which I discovered through Wrong Reel. I mean, it's very grateful, and they do such a great show. And I know James, you've been on it, and he did something where he didn't do it live, but he records it over Skype, and as soon as he doesn't even edit it, he immediately puts it up for his Patreon followers, and then he does an edited version for the iTunes, I guess, and et cetera.
So. I say way too many stupid things to do that. I have to trim and edit, yeah, and massage, and finesse.
Me too. If people only knew. Well, no, I like this idea, Chico, of your kind of guesting and co-hosting. And there's something kind of fun and very cool about this idea while your show is on this little hiatus, that you're still popping up at guesting.
Like,
and you
like
could
Fonzie
kind of
showing up for dinner at...
In Laverne and Shirley?
Lake of Laverne
exactly.
Shirley.
And Mork showing up in Happy Days, I think.
Yes, Mork
actually. They premiered that character on Happy Days.
But Fonzie often had dinner with the Cunningham family on Happy Days.
And I believe that George Jefferson would once or twice showed up in All in the Family after the Jeffersons already went on the air.
I thought the Jeffersons were
established, and they were very popular characters. So they Lear launched a series for fuck Schrader. This is much more fun.
Right,
let's talk different strokes, baby.
Yeah.
Were there any overlaps of different?
Yeah,
strokes?
I think good. Facts of Life. And they showed up on different strokes.
And Mrs. Garrett was the housekeeper on Different Strokes, and then left there to become.
She got fired by Mr. Drummond.
Yes,
right.
in one of the earliest Me Too moments on TV.
Yeah. By the way, Charlotte Ray is still alive, I believe.
Oh, wow.
I believe so.
Huh.
I did not know that.
So, still available for Filmwax Radio.
Absolutely.
If that's not a great... Oh, did you have something? Jeremy has news.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Thank you. I just want to make sure we didn't skip.
Thank you.
Yeah, you got a big trip on the horizon.
My new gig. My new documentary, which is going to premiere at South by Southwest.
I know.
In
days from now.
Less than 2 weeks.
Are you excited?
I am. It is called The World Before Your Feet.
It's a great title, Jeremy.
You like it?
I really do.
Some people are... I love it.
It sounds epic.
It is
epic.
And
it's a very... It is an epic.
The subject matter is somewhat epic.
It is very epic.
Yeah, so this is a documentary that I've been making for the last 3 years. It is about Matt Green, who's 37 years old, who for the last 6 years has been walking every single street of New York City, all five boroughs. He lives off $10 a day. He doesn't have an apartment. He sold all his possessions. There's some listeners might be aware of an older man who also did this and wrote a book about it. And he's actually in my film. His name's William Helmrich. But Matt is who I followed. And it's premiering at South By in competition.
How many miles is that total?
Well, he Let me put it this way. Before we came up with this, you know, arty title, this epic title, The World Before Your Feet, it was called Walk 8,000 Miles in New York.
8,000 miles?
Yes.
That's insane.
So if you counted up all the streets and all the paths and beaches and cemeteries, it would add up to about 8,000 miles. So I filmed him. I probably myself walked over 1,000 miles with him.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Because I filmed him for 3 years and I filmed literally hundreds of hours.
Explains your tight butt.
Yes.
Kind of diminishes the feat of marathon in Sparta or ancient Greece or whatever. 26 miles versus 8,000.
There was one time when we actually walked by a marathon in, you know, that was happening at the moment. And I just kept on, I like sort of looked over there and I was just like, man, you guys are lightweights.
So is he still working
on
this?
Still at it. Okay, you know, my film does not complete the walk. He, got it. It's one of those, you know, endings where he walks off into the distance.
And based on his the amount he's already walked, does he have an ET?
He doesn't. He's a guy who's all about the journey, not the destination.
That's very cool.
He's very much about that.
Good marketing.
Yeah, of course. Point there. And
very well
he just, you know, it's all about just keeping going on.
Didn't Herzog do something like that where he needed a break from filmmaking, so he just walked across all the continent of Europe?
I did hear that. Oh, and he walked to meet a film critic, right?
I can't remember.
I think it was that.
There was a lot of Eisner.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then
he
Linus
wanted to meet her, right?
I remember fragments of the story.
Anyway.
And then filmmaker, actor Linus Phillips, who's been on this podcast, he has a film called Walking to Werner, which is a film where he walked from Seattle to Los Angeles to where Werner had us a house. And he did that walk. And
I
shot that
remember
film.
That movie, yeah.
Yeah.
And
really
I
good.
Did a trailer for his last movie.
Uh-huh. That's the one, Melanie Lynskey.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's funny.
Yeah, no, it's definitely funny.
Maria Abramovich and her ex-husband mm-hmm. or ex-lover, didn't they walk the length? Like they
yep,
started
the Great Wall.
Of the Great Wall yeah. and met in mm-hmm. the middle and then...
Divorced,
yeah.
He's buying property at the Great Wall on the good side.
Anyway, so if listeners are going to be at South By or you're going to, you know...
And some of them will be.
Yeah, please come. Find me. And if not, please follow the movie on Facebook or Twitter. The World Before Your Feet.
James, you're moving. You're moving, as it turns out. So you're going
to
have a new permanent podcast.
Yeah, Wrong Reel 2.0. My place, I love it. I love and adore where I've lived the last 7 years, but it's just I'm constantly setting up for my YouTube channel or setting up for the podcast or just setting up for using my living room as a living room. I'm using the room for too many purposes, so I'm just going to have a slightly more space and a permanent podcasting and YouTube recording area, and hopefully it'll become the coolest place in New York to record long, lengthy, drunken conversations about movies.
I look forward to
all y'all. The door is open. The red carpet is out for y'all.
Sign us up.
Yeah.
It's weird. Batman never moved the Batcave.
Yeah, I know.
Still in the same place always. So this is a big... James Hancock is moving the Hancock Cave.
He was lucky to be born atop
That's right.
a giant labyrinth or a giant cavern. So he didn't need to upgrade. So
who was I talking... Was it you, Jeremy? We were emailing right a few months ago, or last month, whenever it was, about doing a focus on one filmmaker, which I love doing. I know, James, you do this frequently on your podcast. Chico, do you do this type of thing on your podcast?
On Scream Squad, we usually take two movies and two horror movies, and then we sort of look at them, and there's some sort of common theme, like whether it's like, you know, gentrification in horror or, you know, consent in horror or, you know, sort of things like that, and then we'll, you know, So it's definitely, you know, it's theme-based, and usually we take two movies.
That's great. Okay.
So type story.
Okay, because I was going to say, I don't do it frequently. This is really something you do on Wrong Reel
quite
a bit.
I love it. I mean, the work ahead of time, it definitely is a little bit of...
intense.
It's a little bit of a stumbling block for some people, but when guests pitch it to me, I'm all for it. But you were kind enough to come on and do our Sidney Lumet episode, an episode I'm very proud of. And but it's, I try to do it at most once or twice a month, these big, giant topics, especially if you're dealing with a filmmaker with these enormous filmographies.
Oh, wow.
Now I'm starting to, I mean, just yesterday with Tony Stella, the poster designer, we tackled just the early samurai films of Kurosawa. And I figure with Kurosawa,
oh my God,
you got to break it into pieces. You can't do it all in one episode.
Right.
He's a samurai fanatic, so we picked six.
It's crazy.
Yeah, but we had a lot of fun with
that's doable.
Yeah, it's doable. You picked about 35 movies for us.
Yojimbo. Yojimbo, was that in there?
Yojimbo was definitely on the list.
Yeah, with Schrader, what happened was I went by the films I already kind of knew, and it had a lot of recall around. But as I immersed myself in it, I all of a sudden realized, no, that's not going to do. There's so many connections, and there's so many things. And I forgot a couple of films I thought were great in rewatching were kind of more flawed than I remembered. And then I was reintroduced to some films. So it was, I had to rethink the whole thing. And then so I just sort of said, well, let's definitely go include these, but I'm open to talking about any, whether or not he wrote them and or directed them. So how many did you bite off, or how many do you feel like you got through a substantial amount?
I saw a substantial number I've never even seen before.
Me too.
For me, it was a great journey of discovery.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I've probably seen 15.
Right.
I think I've seen most of them at some point, and I rewatched probably 7 or 8.
Me too.
In like the last week and a half.
Yeah. I mean, there's a couple of film titles like you just mentioned, Jeremy, Forever Mine.
No, Forever Mine's the late 90s Gretchen Mol.
Josephine's
movie. Yes. Josephine's. Basically, you know, it's a romantic drama.
Yeah,
they call
it's a, kind of a classic story where a borderline criminal figure's lovely young bride, played by Gretchen Mol, falls in love with like a pool boy, a cabana boy.
Okay,
the husband Ray Liotta doesn't take kindly to it, and it becomes like a revenge saga. But it's probably most notable for a very lovingly photographed sex scene about 30 minutes of the way into it. But not one of my favorite Schrader films.
Yeah, I mean, late 90s Schrader is not, you know. I mean, actually, there's some exceptions to all of this.
I mean, Affliction is one of my personal favorites.
I think,
so.
In a nutshell, that's what you find by watching his films is
yeah.
that.
It's like if you try to say, like, if you try to make generalizations, you know, I mean, of course, it's easy. You could start with, well, he wrote Taxi Driver, and you could sort of start with that. But then once you start digging into decades, it's not so easy just to say, like, oh, he lost his touch, no pun intended, because he made a movie called Touch.
Which I didn't get.
Right, to. Or he, you know, was it his heyday in the 70s or the 80s? I mean, he's still cranking movies out. He has a new one that just was at New York Film Festival and Toronto Film Festival.
And will be at South by Southwest.
And will be at South by Southwest, yeah.
Yeah. 71, right. Still
but
kicking.
But that doesn't mean anything, that just because he's always going to get into film festivals. I mean, he could film himself in the bathroom for 2 hours and it would get into a film festival.
Which Forever Mine would have been an improvement.
I was going to say, I think a lot of his more recent work. I actually have a little bit of a different feeling. I think that, yes, you mentioned that he wrote Taxi Driver, but De Niro starred in Taxi Driver. You know, Scorsese directed it. Was it Ballhouse who shot it? And
I think it was Michael Chapman.
Chapman shot it. Bernard Herrmann. Right. Like, Taxi Driver is, like, firing on all cylinders. I think he benefits. I don't think he has a style, and I think he benefits from who his collaborators are, and often he drags his collaborators down to a pit of mediocrity. And
but that shooting script for Taxi Driver is a thing of gold. When you read the original shooting script, just the voiceover narration and the descriptions, and it's interesting how he has a lot of additional commentary that you can't really shoot. Like, he basically reflects what people are thinking without actually writing it out. So we have that information, but as a DP or as a director, like, well, how am I supposed to reflect that, because you didn't really like write it out, and so it actually has a little bit of a different take on some of the different scenes in the movie. But
I mean, by all means, I'm not saying, I just think that I think he has been lucky to be associated with a lot of the
pedigree.
There's a pedigree there, and I think in a lot of ways, I mean, he's sort of like the Joey Bishop or Peter Lawford of the 70s film kids scene. Right. That he happened to be on the stage when Frank Sinatra and Dean Martin and, you know, Sammy Davis Jr. were doing stuff, but they, you know, he was making a drink in the background. I don't know. I think that's a little. I mean, maybe.
So I mean, you know, you're dealing with someone that a lot of film people look at as a legend, and that a really key voice of the 70s and 80s, and one of the great American, you know, auteurs.
Well, if he had made one film a decade or two, he might have.
Taking
the best of the films that he's made, right, and not made the 3 or 4 mediocre films at best. There's a couple of really bad ones, more than a couple. But if he had stuck with that, he would he would be. I think you're right, Chico. I think that he's worked with such great collaborators. If you keep putting Willem Dafoe in every movie, it does raise the bar, and you're going to get a.
But the Willem Dafoe movies are awesome. Like Light Sleeper is great.
No, I'm saying
Autofocus is great.
He is fantastic.
You know Willem Dafoe's in Dog Eat Dog.
I'm sure.
And he's still.
He's also in. Oh no, I was going to say. He's not in Comfort of Strangers.
No.
Yeah, it's Christopher Walken.
No. Yeah.
Oh,
doing
let's, can't
an atrocious.
Oh, no, no, no. Don't jump the gun. Don't jump the gun. We were going to get into that. Christopher Walken. Fellas.
You got us revved up already.
Yeah. All right. Born in 1946 in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Brought up religiously by Calvinist parents, as Chico mentioned, which of course informed several films, and we'll see coming up, including Hardcore Taxi Driver and Light of Day, for instance. Didn't see a film until he was 17 years old. Okay. Then he went on to earn an MA in film at UCLA, discovered Pauline Kael, became her disciple. She obviously liked him a great deal and believed in him and thought he was a big talent, and she gave him a start writing, and he ended up writing some books of film theory, and then became a film critic at the L.A. Free Press for a while until he started writing, and then he wrote the Yakuza, I guess, right?
Which at the time was like the biggest, script
bidding
sale
war.
Ever.
Yeah, massive bidding
war. But that's the thing. That's what the first thing people mention about Yakuza. They don't mention the great script or the awesome performance.
Hey, I just was on a podcast talking about Yakuza for over
and he
an
co-wrote
hour.
It with his brother Leonard.
Yeah,
as well.
And Robert Towne. Yeah. Right. That's the other thing. I mean, so Robert Towne, a year off from Chinatown, contributes to that script.
Sure.
Like, you know, I don't know who you know how much of it that is him. You're also talking about Sidney Pollack directing it in the prime of his like I think the most underrated.
You were the devil's advocate
director.
Today. That's your role.
Yeah,
that's fine. That's fine.
So, and then on top of all that, there's a Japanese series that William Friedkin worships that was like in the middle of coming out called Battles of Honor Without Humanity.
Kenji Fukasaki's film.
The Yuki's
that's
papers.
A killer play. I saw William Friedkin interview Kenji Fukasaki at the UPA in L.A. That was something special.
And so that
You're
was
getting
going
a little wrong
on,
reel on me right here.
That was going on at the same time. And so then he makes this version, and it's sort of like one of those, like, you know, ninja movies that came out in 81 after all the, you know, ninja.
Revenge of the Ninja.
It's better than that.
No, I know, but I'm saying it was sort of capitalizing on something that was already
but
going on.
Quick question, though, for Adam. Before we get actually into the movies he made, like, what was the source of his falling out with Pauline Kael? I know he was one of her disciples, but there was a major rift at one point, and they basically had nothing to do with each other moving forward.
Well, I think that was not probably unusual for anybody who followed Pauline Kael, that she, from what I've read, that she had very complex relationships with those disciples. Eventually, the disciple, it graduates and wants to move on, and that would threaten her. Now, please call in right now. The lines are open if you want to correct me, but that I have a sense that was not unusual for her and some of the young folks that she
was either on. It was Mark Maron or somebody else's podcast. But he was talking about his experience. But he said basically when Pauline Kael decided to switch from being a critic to temporarily being a producer in L.A., he basically at one point caught her bashing him at a party. He's like, look, you're no longer a critic now. You're an insider, and it changes your role with Hollywood.
Sure.
And I think it was a very brief period where she kind of switched gears, but it was like kind of a career misstep for her when she tried to get into producing as opposed to commentary.
I see.
And also Schrader is, you know, he says his mind, as, you know, I think is evident in the films. And
yeah, he's made a lot of enemies by speaking
very
bluntly.
Yeah, so he's somebody who doesn't hold his tongue and has had
Marcus Penn despises him because of the comments that he's made about Terrence Malick. And so, yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I think he's a great interview. He says crazy, crazy stuff sometimes. Anyway.
Interesting. Well, anyway, so I've heard that she's had some falling out. She had falling outs with some of those disciples. You know, you understand the power structure in those relationships, you know, and somebody can get very,
there's also a gender thing going on there. There's not that many women mentors in Hollywood, and I think his Calvinist upbringing that he's working through in all of his, I think it's the one, there's no style in his movies, but I think this sort of self-destructive guy sort of getting over his demons or being succumbing to his demons comes from his sort of Calvinist upbringing, but I think there's also like some atrocious sexual politics in a lot of his movies, and I think that comes from his Calvinism. And then you combine with him being mentored by a woman at a time when that was less common than it is now. I mean, she's a very unique figure.
You could say even one of a kind. I mean, she's a one of the few critics that filmmakers to this day swear by in terms of her writing and how they learned to
and how they've interpreted. Exactly. I mean, she taught two or three whole generations how to look at movies.
I mean, Tarantino talks about how her review of Band of Outsiders, he said basically Godard found the poetry in between the lines of a kind of a tawdry, trashy novel. And he's like, whoa, I never even thought about even like thinking about movies that way. And it just opened his eyes. So yeah, she was a monumental figure.
The author of Taxi Driver comes Blue Collar, the story of three men who spend their whole lives working to catch up.
There's going to be some changes, man, in the union. Big changes.
Everybody know what the plant is. The plant just short for plantation.
I was on that picket line every day.
That's right.
I'm still paying the bills and the money out of bar to support my family.
Who is it?
Brown?
Yes?
Yeah, my name is Mr. Berg. I'm with the Internal Revenue.
I don't want none.
But according to the hospital records, you claim six and you only have three.
I couldn't have all my kids in the hospital, man, you know.
Here, see, we have Sugar Ray Brown, you got Gloria Brown, you got O.J. Brown, Gail Sayers Brown, Jim Brown, Stevie Wonder Brown. Who's Stevie Wonder?
So I could see that having being, you know, this also a chafe, you know, for this guy who... you know, clearly is working some stuff out with his relationships with women, with his, you know, with his movies.
Yeah, right. And now that we've all been watching so many of them, oscillating between the religious conflicts and the sexual conflicts that he has and that keep coming back in his films, going back to Taxi Driver, right?
Which so, I guess he wrote right after the Yakuza.
Which I have to say it doesn't make sense because he got all this. They got all this money for Yakuza, and then he's writing Taxi Driver, like living in Hell's Kitchen, going to porn
and
movies every day,
and he
just
talks
doing
about how
coke
he was broke.
And, yeah, so that kind of doesn't make a whole. But maybe there were debts, or you know, I know he split the money for Whatchamacallit with Town and his brother, and you know. But again, I mean, this guy's got as many main characters who are like porn or sex addicts as Woody Allen has protagonists who date underage girls. It's a recurring theme.
But you could also say it's a recurring theme of, you know, the underbelly of society. It's not necessarily just porn.
Yeah,
sex.
But there's a different thing than sort of the porn or stuff that appears in like noir movies, like, you know, The Big Sleep or something like that, which porn is like, there's a backdrop of porn in a lot
or
of movies.
Sex
but
trafficking
his,
or
yeah,
sex
his,
trade.
His movies have, you know, his guys are... Their porn addiction is a main part of their, you know, I mean,
well, Travis... Didn't he go to a pretty dark place in his personal life where he was doing a lot of cocaine.
And going...
A lot of drugs.
And apparently he would write... And
hanging out with James Toback.
An empty gun next to his head and he would pull the trigger over and over again while snorting lines and hammering on the keyboard.
Is that true?
That could be a fabrication by Peter Biskin, but in his book, Easy Rider, Raging Bulls, he talks
so
about
years.
How Paul Schrader would just... It was a way of kind of getting in his groove. He would get properly jacked...
Right.
Pull the trigger a few times and hammer out some words for Travis Bickle. And...
Yeah, I mean, I think there's also a little bit
no
of...
There's no Excedrin in the...
But I think there's a little bit of, like, a myth with him, especially in those kind of, like, post-Taxi Driver era. You know, he cranked out that script in 2 weeks or whatever it was. Then he goes... He's pulled on to write part of Raging Bull and just, like...
Close Encounters.
Yeah. Like, there's this cult of Paul
Which
Schrader that has worked to his advantage... For...
Sure, but I mean, like, again, Spielberg threw out, you know, everything from the Close Encounters. And I'm not diminishing, I mean, his contribution, I'm not saying he was just there on stage like Peter Lawford or Joey Bishop, but there is, you know, again, I mean, I think when you think of Raging Bull or one of these, it's not, Paul Schrader's contribution is not the first thing you think.
But it's also possible because of his Calvinist upbringing, his strict upbringing, that he postponed that adolescence until he was an adult. Here he is all of a sudden with... he may not have been, maybe had a lot of money at his access, but he's had this, all of a sudden, a career. He's living in New York, and all of a sudden, it was like, you know, the devil's playground. Here he is. And so, and at the time, these films were, like, Midnight Cowboy was a big success. While controversial, it was still a huge success, right? And it feels like his films were very much a reflection of that.
He also, he said something interesting about how the way he looks at movies, he never looks at them. Most people get super nostalgic about the movies that they are brought up watching. And he, because he didn't watch any movies, he says he's always looked at them from a much more intellectual, kind of a cold objective distance, as opposed to the emotional, nostalgic way that a lot, someone like Scorsese, who was going to see like Sam Fuller movies when he was 6 years old and that sort of thing. But it definitely puts him in a different category, I think, than your traditional hardcore cinephile directors like Peter Bogdanovich and Martin Scorsese.
It's true. He's not really riffing on – I mean, he is, but not quite like those guys, where it's a very postmodern and it's riffing on these other directors and other movies. He's kind of bringing this – his own – you know, for lack of a better description, I mean, a real sort of auteur sort of vision to it, where it's his thing. You know, you could sort of sense the his view of the world in these movies, even though they differ in a lot of subjects.
Have any of y'all read Transcendentalism in Film, the one he wrote about Dreyer, Ozu, and Bresson?
No, kinda, but that's famous.
Skipped through it.
Yeah, I read bits and pieces, but, you know, it's pretty dry, heavy stuff, but it's very religious, and it's very, it's a very ambitious piece of work, but it's not necessarily designed to keep you riveted from start to finish.
It's scholarly.
Right? Yeah, that's scholarly.
I mean, it's Schrader, then went in 76, Taxi Driver comes out, big success for him. He seems to manage, though, some relationships pretty well. Maybe people just were enamored with this dark, his dark side, because he was able to pilfer Michael Chapman, who shot Taxi Driver, and right, and then he ended up working with him on Hardcore. Now, wait, did he shoot? He didn't shoot Blue. Did he shoot
Blue Collar? Blue Collar as well? Yeah, Blue Collar is
right.
First,
right, but did Chapman shoot that? I forget. Anyway, it's okay.
I think he just shot Hardcore.
Yeah. So, but he did also. He worked with Nietzsche, Jack Nietzsche, which I thought was great. I don't know if where he met him, but he did work with him as a composer. Both Blue Collar and Hardcore. It's an interesting film that he would shoot a movie about blue collar workers, you know, for his first film. And then when you know more about him, it makes sense that that's the types of people he kind of grew up knowing.
Still my favorite Richard Pryor performance.
Yeah. I mean, and that was the thing. I think that was the movie they were trying to get Richard Pryor to be, sort of
1978,
be this, you know, dramatic actor, because he had just been, you know, stand-up comedy, you know, known for his stand-up. Mm-hmm. And then you've also got Yaphet Kotto. You've got, you know, Harvey Keitel, a really sort of great cast.
The cast is outrageously good.
I mean, it's really one of the best, like, sort of union movies, if not the best sort of union movie.
Until Norma Rae, at least.
I was thinking of, it was before this, the documentary, the Barbara Kopple documentary. Oh,
American Dreamer. That,
There were two. Harlan County, USA, and then American Dreamer.
Yeah. And then American, is the American Dream the one about the Hormel factory?
Yes.
Yeah. That one's really good too. But those are docs. Like, this is the sort of I mean, I guess when you start looking at his career, I mean, he really does have the defining Werecat movie, and he's got the defining Union movie. I mean, there's a couple of genres.
The defining male hooker movie.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's kind of true.
American Gigolo.
No, I would say Midnight Cowboy.
All right.
Good point. You're right. You're way right about that.
Yeah.
But he only has like two tricks in there. John Boyd,
but he does travel across the country.
He's very bad at it.
He's not very adept at it.
No, Richard Gere, who is Julian, what's the character? Julian.
I can't remember his last name.
Yeah. But by the way, it was supposed to go to Travolta, apparently, right?
Chickened out.
Yeah, and they had to.
Thank God.
Giorgio.
Moroder?
No, not Giorgio Moroder. The suit guy had to make all new suits.
Oh, Armani?
Giorgio Armani.
Yeah, Giorgio Armani.
Wow.
Yeah. These are some good looking suits.
Yeah. They are.
Yeah, Gere. Who, you know, has anybody met Gere?
No.
Okay. So I'm sitting in, I just want to mention this because it is like one of these cliches that is absolutely based in fact. So I'm sitting in an office, a publicist's office, and all of a sudden, Gere's in the movie, but I'm not supposed to interview him, right? But he comes out, he looks at me, and he makes a beeline right for me. He goes, "Have we met?" And I lied. I just said, yes.
Good answer.
I don't know. Nice. And I said, I don't know why I just said that. No, we have not met, but it's very nice to meet you.
Sure.
And your name is...
No, you got
so
you
I introduced myself.
Before Star Power. My dad met Sidney Poitier once.
Really...
He said, you know, you have a really interesting face. And you would have thought my dad had like had sex with Marilyn Monroe. Like he was like walking on rose petals. Like, he says, I have an interesting face. And he was so excited. So, yeah.
That's funny.
Well,
you know, Richard Gere was, they say, has basically been blacklisted by China. Like no studio will put him in a movie because of his pro-Tibet anti-China stuff. Like he made a couple of movies that were sort of anti-China, and he's been very pro-Tibet, and at this point no major studio will put him
in a movie. A lot of Hollywood money comes from China.
Yeah, wow. He's had to just do indie stuff for like 10 or 15
That's
years.
Right.
Like they've successfully...
With Oren Moverman, it's right, he's collaborating with Oren Moverman, the Israeli American.
I mean, he's
American
in cool indie movies,
director.
But he's not.
It was
in any
financial
studio,
crisis movie. Did
no, he hasn't
ago.
Been in
that
a major studio.
That was also
studio.
Pretty.
I mean, he was.
Yeah.
He was groomed to be a major studio star. Now, I'm not a huge fan of young Gere. I actually find him to be exactly what
facile.
You just described. Well, to be like what you get when you can't get John Travolta.
Oh, really?
I find him to be like a.
I thought he's much better.
A less oh really? Because I find Travolta to be he's like a grumpier John Travolta.
Yeah,
basically.
For sure. He's a darker. Yeah, John Travolta was always more the sunnier version.
Yeah, John Travolta is
the
like
two,
ethnic. Though. But I mean, he's Italian. He's an Italian American from Brooklyn.
Yeah, but who went on to like try to cleanse himself of ethnicity throughout the years? But I always felt like they were two sides of a coin or two different sides of the same coin because their careers definitely kind of weaved here and there. You know, like
Travolta was also supposed to be in the Malick movie. Right? In
Days of Heaven. Yes. And then I think he dropped out of American Gigolo to do Urban Cowboy. I mean,
right,
you know,
that's right.
No disrespect to it, but it pales. I mean, I think actually American Gigolo, there was a strong voice, a directorial voice in there. It's not the greatest film, but I think it has a strong...
It's got a pulse to it that is undeniable, though. I think I've seen that easily.
And a style to it, which is...
You know who I am. I know who you are. I know what you're thinking. You know what I'm thinking. You want to be here. You want to be with me.
His name is Julian Kay.
So what do you expect?
His business is pleasure.
Hello, Judy. You're a very sexy lady. Very good looking woman. You can like me. I can tell. We have a lot of fun.
He is the American Gigolo.
Hello, girls.
How about you? How do you get pleasure?
How do you do what you're in? How do you seduce all these women? Please think you're involved in a murder in Palm Springs a week ago.
I'm being framed by somebody. I don't know.
You've been identified, Julian.
Richard Gere, Lauren Hutton, American Gigolo.
Right. Okay. So now there's the thing. How much of that style is Bruckheimer and Dante Spinotti and Giorgio Moroder?
Like, that's
that's a director's job as much as telling an actor to move over to the left. I mean, I think that defining a style through your selection of collaborators is as much.
But
is
those
valid...
two, that and Cat People look very different than anything that Schrader's done. And those are the Giorgio Moroder, Jerry Bruckheimer, and I think is it Dante Spinotti or
Spinotti did some of the later stuff. I think it was John
both
Bailey.
Those two. I know Spinotti definitely was involved in.
Yeah,
I have such a problem with the ending of America. Like, American Gigolo is this movie about, like, this robot guy who has no emotions, who has sex with women, and then this beautiful woman falls in love with him and then gives, like, his... Mm-hmm. Like, I actually think if he ended up in jail, it would be a great noir.
It
would be a great neo-noir.
Yeah, well, he loves it.
I know, but I don't know. I feel like it would have been really bad. And I was... I don't know. I definitely feel like that ending is just, I mean, it's
interesting that you were talking about the endings, because I was listening to, anybody listen to the audio commentary for Hardcore?
No.
Okay, sorry. I only got it yesterday because I was literally listening today, like on my phone, iPhone, and I downloaded that one. I downloaded Blue Collar. There's a few of his films, so you can just download the audio commentaries for it. That would have been helpful to add to our bucket of content, which I didn't get around to in time. But he talks about how disappointed that he gave into the studio, as it sounds like maybe until he had enough power, if he ever did, that he would cave into the studio. They liked the happy ending. So in Hardcore, for instance, which hardly seems like the studio would want to even get made, but since they greenlighted it, they wanted him to be reunited with the daughter and the daughter to be okay. But in the original screenplay, it had a much more ambiguous, open-ended ending. So she wasn't, didn't agree to go home and, reunite with her dad.
The real happy ending would have been if George C. Scott also were to take the prostitute home with him as well, who's been helping him follow the trail. Like, that would be the true happy ending. I'm going to adopt you, and you're going to come back to Michigan.
Family.
Absolutely. But they didn't go all the way on the sugary happy ending.
I mean, those are, he does Blue Collar and then as his first movie, and then his second movie is Hardcore. I mean, that's it's pretty impressive.
I think his first four movie streak is pretty hard to deny. I mean, if you go Blue Collar, Hardcore, American Gigolo, and then Cat People, I think all four of those movies are wildly distinctive. I mean, maybe this is why, going back to, like, is he an auteur? Maybe not, because the movies are so different, but I find all four of those movies irresistibly compelling to watch. I mean, when I lived in L.A., I would watch American Gigolo pretty much every time I went out. I would put it on to get, like, in the mood to go out and, like, party, which maybe that's the wrong message to get from the movie, because it's kind of a dark film.
Yeah.
But it would get me insanely fired up to go out and explore the underbelly of L.A. I just, I fell
into
that.
Yeah, I also...
It's a very legit LA movie and a very legit, like, aesthetic and stylish. I was just questioning whether Schrader deserves credit for the stylish. Certainly deserves credit for the, LA, the cold LA. I mean, the same LA that we see in the canyons later on, and so. I don't want to sound like I'm just denigrating him as a talent. I just think that. This is in response to, like, what Jeremy was saying earlier about him being, like, an auteur and a legend. And I mean, I get that he deserves to sit at the table, but he should be getting up and going over to the kids' table a lot.
Well, don't even like Comfort of Strangers. I can't deny
Comfort of Strangers is not terrible.
I prefer Bitter Moon.
If
I'm going to watch movies about couples being exposed to horrible things in Europe, Bitter Moon.
Bitter Moon's better.
And Sheltering Sky was in the Mediterranean, Morocco. Well, we just want to mention, as we move in from the first chapter, which is those four films, is a good way to do it, and then into the next, his experiences also with Richard Pryor, and how, I mean, unbelievably difficult it was to work with,
and he talks about quite a bit.
Yeah,
due to substance abuse or what?
Yes,
he just primarily. Talks about the difficulty of dealing with Richard Pryor in a way that you've never heard a director talk about an
actor. And what's great about the audio commentary for Hardcore is how much he says the same as George C. Scott, like how he was a severe alcoholic. I mean, it may have been particularly bad during that film and that period of Scott's life, but he was really difficult. And at one point, Scott said he would only come out and do this scene towards the end if Schrader agreed never to direct another movie.
Wow.
He said, "You're a good writer, but you suck at directing."
It's a powerhouse performance. So George Schrader is magnetic in that movie.
So apparently he gets hired to direct American Gigolo, and George C. Scott runs into him. And he said, "Yeah, George, I'm sorry." Because he's confronted by George C. Scott. Of course, the reviews for Hardcore were not bad. I don't think. I don't
remember. And it's held up.
Why do you think? I mean, I think it's a very mediocre film in retrospect. Like, what it really? I mean, a lot of non-professionals. It's clear they're not professionals. He puts in Dick Sargent from Bewitched in there. Why? Like, it's like...
The movie's got Big Dick Black in it.
Yep.
Oh, sorry?
One of the characters.
Oh. Is that
one of the guys who
Dick
auditions.
Williams?
One of the guys who auditions.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
And the ending is like, you know, his that scene in the production studio where they shoot all the snuff and the porn and all that. I mean, it's just so tacky. And
right,
the, and,
but
and
you're
the scene
talking
where
about
George
the
comes out with the wig.
There had never been a movie about porn, I don't think, up until then.
But Taxi Driver's a taste.
All right, Taxi Driver takes her to a porn theater.
I mean,
but,
there's a couple of scenes in porn.
Okay,
theaters,
fine, but
and there's teenage hookers.
Hardcore is about somebody, you know. It's a it's a Dante's Inferno where he's
right.
going
very,
and descending
exactly right.
into the world of pornography.
Right, yeah.
That had never been done,
and he's strangely unaffected after an initial bit of shock. But what I find that fascinating about that movie is how, despite his strict Calvinist background and his very wholesome background back in Michigan, he actually is almost like he stops being shocked, and he just kind of like. Is openly mm-hmm. disdainful and dismissive of it. He's like, all right, I get what's going on here.
Right.
I'm not impressed. Like
right.
when people auditioning, yeah. we'll show them their privates, etc. And he's just kind of
right.
scowls and kind of
yeah, very
brushes
good.
Them out.
Very, well, because he goes for, in search of his daughter, who's disappeared on a school trip or a church group trip, and then he decides to go undercover in the. In the sex trade in San Diego.
Yeah,
so,
San Diego.
All right. Well, it starts in L.A., but she should have run away to New York. Anyway.
But it deals with, like, sex trafficking.
Yeah.
It deals with... There's
young
a
girls.
Snuff film in it. I mean,
it,
it's pretty...
It gets increasingly dark as it
it's
goes.
It's pretty extreme.
I guess so,
I
yeah.
mean, you know, uh-huh. there was that terrible Nick Cage movie, 8mm, which...
Oh, my God.
...is
directed by Joel Schumacher.
yeah.
On top of everything
the,
else.
Who...
Not,
sure, we
not
could have done
nearly
Joel
as
Schumacher,
good as Hardcore.
Right. We could have looked at the career of Joel Schumacher. It's true.
Oh, I'll be ready for that.
Nothing but rubber nipples.
Anyway, I'm a fan of Hardcore. I
so
think
am I. Yeah.
Okay. No, no. I think it's a. But more works as a. No, well, do you say novelty, Chico? I mean,
yeah,
I don't think
I,
it was.
So I think of those first four movies. They are interesting. But, like, when you compare them, again, to, like, heavy hitters' first movies, like, it's not...
Coppola.
Like, they're all flawed pretty majorly. I mean, it's interesting, because for me, my favorite of the four is probably Cat People, and that's a pretty flawed movie.
What did they tell you about me?
I knew I had a brother, but I was only four. I used to fantasize about you when I was in the orphanage.
Yes, I had the same dreams.
See these eyes so green. I can't stand.
I didn't think you were ready, but you are. I knew it when I saw you with him. Your whole body burns.
I'm not like you!
Tell yourself that it's love, but it isn't. It's blood. Death.
Frankly, Black Panther, the number one movie, I mean, has about 10 minutes in the movie that are clearly straight out of Cat People.
No, well, Marcus Penn out there, you want to do some side-by-sides.
Yeah.
Cat People,
really?
Black Panther.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
interesting.
I mean, well, just all the opening stuff with,
okay.
like, you know, the tree,
yeah,
oh.
Panther.
Oh, wow,
and,
yeah. They're shot in the with the red filter and all.
Yeah, I mean, there's some... I mean, look, I you know, but they're all... They're almost all like if you could imagine a movie in the 70s with Richard Pryor, Yaphet Kotto, mm-hmm. and Harvey Keitel directed by, you know, the writer of Taxi Driver, I feel like you would get something maybe a little bigger and better than Blue Collar. And
it's a small movie,
yeah, they're all
well directed. I mean, the performances are
it
great.
Is,
they,
yeah.
The guys hate each other. They weren't talking even by the end. You wouldn't know it from the performances. Yeah. I mean...
Although that final scene when they're basically all splitting apart
right,
the scenes,
right.
you definitely can feel some tension. Obviously, it's part of the
well,
part of the story
that helped
being engineered.
You know.
But I think Paul Schrader, if I was going to have like a lasting impression of his entire career, is that he makes a lot of small, dangerous little movies. Sometimes they succeed, sometimes they don't, sometimes they're inconsistent. But I admire the fact that for the last 40 years, he's been at least fighting the good fight on that front.
I agree with that statement that he makes small movies and some of them work, some of them don't. which I think is fine. I mean, I think, you know, we've lionized like these Sam Fuller and Robert Aldrich, like these guys from mm-hmm. the Hollywood era who, you know, like didn't stick to a specific
Nick
genre.
Ray.
Nicholas Ray. Yeah, Nicholas Ray. People like that. And I think he kind of falls into that category, although with more misses than hits than those guys.
For sure.
Because, like, you know, you go for, you know, I mean, he's got Cat People and the Exorcist sequel, but he's also got
prequel,
you know, Blue Collar. Prequel, exactly. Yeah, sorry. Yeah. He's also got, you know, Blue Collar
right.
and, you know, The Affliction. I mean,
Mishima.
You
know.
Right. Mishima 4X.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Which is
Is that Mishima, what he did right after Cat People?
Yeah, I think it is.
And oh,
yeah.
By the way, I think I read somewhere a quote attributed to Nastassja Kinski, who is in Cat People.
Who became his...
Right, so she said, I have to sleep with all my directors, and Paul made it harder than any of the others, which I just think is an amazing
she
did,
she didn't
quote.
Make it harder?
You know, yeah, exactly. And
well,
I think
he has complicated... personal sex.
Yes.
And you get the sense from his movies, he's often exploring certain boundaries. Like, you can't watch a movie like Comfort of Strangers and not think that he's exploring what it might be like to have sex with Rupert Everett and people like that. Like, I get the sense he's very bi-curious. I don't know whether or not it was ever really acted on, but American Gigolo is definitely an exploratory movie. Like,
and
when he goes to the gay nightclub.
Yeah,
I mean,
I think that's why Richard Gere works, too, because I think Richard was always, I mean, bi-curious.
Yeah.
And I think... And open to exploring that. I think he urged Strader to go deeper.
Yeah.
No pun intended.
Metaphorically speaking.
I mean, I think Cat People and Gigolo also, though, and this maybe follows with Chico's point a little bit, both of those feel like Scorsese might have turned them down. Mm. And then they were like, oh, well, who do we get? Oh, well, let's get the guy that works with Scorsese.
Although
especially Cat People.
Can you imagine, though, the Scorsese doing a Jacques Tourneur remake in like the early 80s?
Of course.
He loves Jacques
Tourneur. He loves Tourneur.
That's
he
what
loves
I mean. That's what I'm saying.
But don't pitch a better movie.
Yeah, no, I'm just saying, like, it should have been Scorsese doing that.
He was doing King of Comedy.
Yeah.
Which, actually, that's a great movie. Yeah, I am more positive about Trader than I'm coming off in this conversation. But
well, you're talking yourself into it.
I do think it's it is worth pointing some of these things out. I mean, I've been disappointed by a lot of it.
Quick question though, of the great 70s auteurs, and there are a ton of them, who wrote more screenplays than Paul Schrader? Like, a lot of them are great visual stylists.
John Milius.
Milius is a great one. But yeah, but if you look at like Scorsese and De Palma,
not a
and all those guys, they're not necessarily writer driven. I think it's interesting how Paul Schrader comes to it from like the text and kind of builds up from there. Whereas a lot of these other guys are visual stylists.
Oliver Stone and Milius both come out of writing scripts in the 70s, and I think are more successful directors.
And then also coming out of the 60s is Townsend, but he was clearly writing through the 70s. Right.
Robert Towns.
Different character.
Did Robert Towns direct before To Kill a Sunrise? And, you know, did he?
Personal Best,
Personal Best. Yeah. I don't count.
But, like, a lot of those, it's a good point. Who did the two Jakes?
Yeah, he did Two Jakes, absolutely.
Right, so they gave these guys. No, Jack Nicholson did the Two Jakes, didn't he?
Yeah, you're right. He did.
So, you know, I think a lot of these guys, like, it's the same thing that, you know, Warner Brothers wants Ben Affleck to do Batman so that. He'll do other Warner Brothers movies. Like Clint Eastwood, you know, Warner Brothers let him do whatever he wanted so that he would do Clint Eastwood movies for them. So I think, like, with Schrader and Town and a lot of these writers, like, these are write-offs, the movies that they give these guys.
But Town wrote successful movies. I don't get the sense there are a lot of hits in Paul Schrader's
There's
film
not a lot of hits, and he's still cranking them out.
Well, are we talking about directing or writing?
Just in general.
I mean,
Paul
what
Schrader.
Was the last
one?
I mean, Rolling Thunder, I can't imagine was an enormous success. And, like,
no,
Obsession.
But what a good
was
that. I really liked Rolling Thunder.
What was the last
I was traumatized
with
Rolling Thunder. I had no idea the movie was that dark. I saw it for the first time, and I'd always heard about it because Tarantino had that video company for a while in the 90s called Rolling Thunder Pictures. And I was like, Tommy Lee Jones, and these guys, I mean, that's a dark, dark, sinister movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, look, I applaud the fact that he's continuing. I find him very likable. I find Kevin Smith to be very likable. I think Kevin Smith movies
almost died today.
Are, like, literally an abomination. Yeah. Like, I think his If Kevin Smith's movies were children and we lived in an ancient tribe, like, they should be left out in the woods to die or be eaten by wolves. So I think, you know, but I find him to be very likable, and I find Schrader to be very likable and interesting.
He's a good interview.
He's a really good interview. He's a smart guy.
You want Paul Schrader to be out there making movies.
Right. Yeah. You want Paul Schrader, but you kind of want those movies to be better a lot of the time.
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to bring up The Comfort of Strangers, which...
No, but that's not his best period anyway.
Oh, that 90s period's grim.
Fits and starts.
It does. You know, Light of Day was this massive flop that, you know, Michael J. Fox wanted to be in serious dramas. And
right,
not just
coming out of the...
Teen Wolf.
So did Joan Jett.
And Joan Jett. And it's
Buster Keaton might have had more expressions on his face during that movie than Joan Jett.
It was a big disaster.
She just had one expression the entire film. Yeah. She was so...
Yeah,
bad in that movie.
So she
but this
was
means
bad.
War. The way that she records in that first opening bit, I like This Means War in that movie. It's a good little tune.
Oh yeah, well that's well. And Springsteen, of course, supplied "Light of the Day," the titular track, and he came in to vet the film for its rock and roll authenticity, which is a joke.
You may remember me. My name is Joe Rask.
Poo back in Cleveland, but around here you just warm snap.
All right, let's not get nasty. I know the 60s must have been rough.
Are you ready to party? Yeah! Are you ready to rock and roll?
From what I can see, you're not a fit mother.
And since when are you an authority on fit mothers?
This is your time.
Since when are you an authority on anything?
Wait.
Well, come on!
There was something where Springsteen was going to be in the movie or something like that.
One thing that happened was that Schrader, I think he gave him the screenplay, was it, or something? He wanted Springsteen to vet something. And at the time, the film was called Born in the USA and not Light of Day. And Bruce Springsteen ended up, like, writing Light of Day for the film, and then Schrader changed the name of the film to Light of Day, and Springsteen took Born in the USA for his latest album.
So
I might have a tiny fact in there a little wrong, but essentially that's the story with that. And he did, apparently, according to Wikipedia, Wikipedia, he vetted, you know, the film. But it's a joke because the film is so, like most Hollywood movies, especially back then, they just had no idea about what rock was versus new wave music versus punk, because that band is all over the place with what they're trying, their attitude, their dress, and, you know, the music itself, which is kind of odd. I just meant Joan Jett absolutely probably had nothing to say about anything.
I mean, it's interesting because also in the 80s, Family Ties castmate also had a rock movie that was actually much better.
Tina Yasmith was in a...
No. But Justine Bateman's Satisfaction is definitely better than Light of Day.
Light of Day is pretty bad.
Yeah.
Anyone a fan?
Because when I was a kid, I was a Michael J. Fox freak. And then when Light of Day came, I was like, what is this? And I kept seeing, like, music videos and, like, trailers, but had zero appeal. I didn't see it for the first time until I was 41 years old.
Julia Roberts is in Satisfaction.
Interesting.
Yeah, she's the bass player.
Was this before Mystic Pizza?
This was before Mystic Pizza. Just as Laura Dern is the bass player in The Fabulous Stains, which I like to mention every time.
That's an example of a movie that gets it right.
That's correct. Yes,
whereas,
absolutely.
Like, you know, this was just so wrong.
Light of Day is embarrassing. It's squeamish.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah. You know.
And then reductive in terms of Jenna Rowland's whole trajectory, that whole subplot. And dumb.
And not like giving, the mean, not giving, mean mom stuff.
And not giving Father...
Father Karras,
like two lines.
He's always Father Karras, no matter what movie.
What is that guy doing over there at the dinner table? By the way, he's just sitting there.
The most intense hour.
Power of Christ compels you.
Yeah,
exactly. Could it compel him to say a line in the script? Right. There's no.
Yeah.
I mean, he actually has no. It's weird. He just sits there with no lines.
Do you know who he's the father of? What famous actor? Jason Patrick.
Oh, okay.
No way.
Yeah. Jason Miller is Jason Patrick's father.
Interesting. Yeah. Although I will say there's one little bit at the end of Light of Day that I do enjoy where I always feel like people forget just how different rock stars are versus movie stars. And Michael J. Fox is singing the tune, and then Joan Jett comes out and starts singing. End. And you're like, oh, you're a fucking rock star. You can sing your ass off. Michael J. Fox, you're a movie star. You can't sing at all.
Yeah.
It's like just the incredibly stark contrast where when Joan Jett starts, when that mean, nasty, throaty voice comes out, it's kind of undeniable. So, yeah, this is the girl who, I mean, she is there a better female rock star of the 1980s than Joan Jett? I mean, you can maybe make Pat Benatar or Madonna, but Joan Jett's kind of a Hall of Famer, top of the
heap. Pretenders.
Chrissy Hynde.
Joan Jett is the mix, the top.
God,
for sure.
Godmother.
But yeah, I mean, you're talking about a movie that definitely disappoints here. I mean, it's got this, you know, Joan Jett. It's got Michael J. Fox at the height of...
Right. I think people need to remember... I don't think people realize that, like, after Back to the Future, there was a six-year period where Michael J. Fox was absolutely, like, number one box office, you know, Teen Wolf.
Yeah.
You know, like, he was...
But he was also reaching, doing Bright Lights, Big City, and, like, Casualties of War. He was trying to break out.
He was trying to do those movies.
Oh, yeah, no. Light of Day was his the first in a series, and almost all the others were significantly better. I mean, you know, just...
But isn't this movie also Schrader's attempt to kind of go Hollywood again after the experiment of Mishima, A Life in Four Chapters? Because I feel like that's a movie that has a really intense but very small but vocal fan base, but it's a highly experimental movie that doesn't work for a lot of people. And obviously, I'm sure Paul Schrader was like, I need to kind of like reestablish my Hollywood credentials after doing Mishima.
He was an intellectual who advocated action. He was a rebel who fought for tradition. He was an artist who shocked the world. Francis Ford Coppola and George Lucas present a new film by Paul Schrader. Mishima.
I mean, Nick Nolte is another one of the, but like, you know, you just sort of, I don't know, I consider Affliction to definitely be one of the four or five.
It's a watchable
best,
film.
Okay, but Light Sleeper, you're not.
The problem, I haven't seen Light Sleeper, and Light Sleeper I rented right after it came out. It was at a time when I was renting movies based on how much nudity I thought they had in them.
It's got a little bit in it.
Didn't have enough.
Not like I was really into
Dana Delaney because when I was
not
a teenager, like I watched
Tombstone.
No, the TV show she was on, China Beach.
China Beach.
Like
she was
that
great
informed
that.
My puberty.
Yeah, no, she was. That's a good show.
Yeah, well,
it's
yeah.
interesting that Dana Delaney's career was totally derailed by that like S&M movie with Rosie O'Donnell and Dan Aykroyd.
Oh, with the S&M thing.
Yeah,
like an S&M
that
thing?
Totally derailed her, destroyed her
career.
Oh,
poor thing. Well, she's still working.
She's still
she's
on
a TV show.
Yeah,
I think she's alive on TV.
Well, I mean,
we should mention that Cat People also. Cat and Cat People also. Malcolm McDowell and
Ruby D.
But Malcolm McDowell has nude scenes as well, and so does
John Hurt.
John Hurt has a lot of nude.
And I think people also might not realize how big John Hurt was in the early 20s.
He was coming up
early 80s.
In the context of nudity, you're not talking about in the context of nudity. You're talking about as a star.
Just talking about sort of what a star he was.
He was the male lead in that movie.
Yeah, like
Chilly Sins of Winter straight through Home Alone, I guess you could say.
Yeah,
and they
he's
did
in
Sopranos.
That really good prison movie. He's
Cutter's,
in a good prison movie.
Cutter,
not
Cutter's,
Cutter's
Way.
No, there's
John
another.
Hurt's
there's a
big.
Prison movie.
He's the kind of rival boyfriend and big to Tom Hanks.
Oh, okay. I forgot about that.
Yeah, yeah. Sure.
Yeah, you know, he's had a great career, and so unfortunately, he's gone.
He died last year.
Yeah.
But he's damn good in Cat People. Like that one bit when the leopard is swinging at the window and he like hangs from the ladder and kind of has a pull up. You know, he's a macho kind of man.
It's a corny movie though. I mean,
it's
like,
a little corny.
It's corny. Like,
it's
okay,
dated.
Here's the truth. Like first thing is how'd you get up on that tree?
Yeah,
you know,
it's ridiculous.
No, the scene that's the most ridiculous for me in Cat People. I'm sorry, listeners, we are popping around. We were doing well for a while, but now this is the round where we're just sort of going crazy here. We're tearing apart some films. But in Cat People, they transform like in Altered States. They're actually like, you know, they do the transform. They bend their arm back and they look like, you know, and they start to go bug-eyed. And then they transform. So how is it at the end, there's a guy in the cat Like, you know, it's like the arm comes out. But if he's transforming into an animal, how is it that a person's inside of the animal at the same time?
Makes no sense.
It makes no sense.
Right.
Yeah.
There's like anybody could have figured that out. It's just a bad movie.
Yeah.
In the end.
It's
But it's.
It's got some style.
But Nastassja Kinski is unbelievable in the other
entirely.
Her commitment to it and Malcolm McDowell, the two of them.
There's a lot of nudity, famously.
Yeah. And if you're a fan of cats, I mean, there's not a lot of stuff that you can get on screen.
One of them is vicious arm rip-off scenes in movie history.
Yes.
Oh, my God. Poor Ed Begley Jr.,
Ed
another
Begley
recurring
Jr.
actor.
Hardcore, yeah, he was in Hardcore.
He's in Hardcore, and he's in, I think, one other.
He's
he was in
Blue Collar.
Oh, wow. Again, a lot of recurring roles. And I will only say of what's the, no, I don't have any notes in front of me, but the we were just talking about it.
Light Sleeper?
No, no, no.
Comfort of Strangers?
Thank you. Comfort of Strangers. It's just, it is, for me, that's my...
Least favorite.
He's probably made
it.
Movies that are worse than that. However, it's my least favorite as well.
Yeah. It's just because it tries so hard for being classy and being... I mean, and all these people are just so...
But that's also not... I mean, yeah, it's a Schrader movie, but it's also, it's like a Harold Pinter script. It's an Ian McEwan novel.
It's all flounder. It's all wasted. It's all, because
I watched it the first time ever last night, thanks to you, and thanks for all the connections on watching the flicks. But I was blown away by just how I openly just reviled and despised Comfort Strangers. I think it's easily his most
pretentious
film.
It's very pretentious.
Shit. And Christopher Walken should have been like Nicolas Cage in his most outrageous roles. Christopher Walken, it was kind of over the top, but for some reason it just felt so flat. His
it's almost
mannerisms,
like Josephine's scars
and the
tics. That stupid one they did in 1999 or whatever. But between Josephine's and his scars,
oh right,
in that late 90s when he did, and Christopher Walken's accent, Comfort of Strangers, I feel like those are the low watermarks.
Yes. I have a daughter, and I'm just going to have him sit up in front in the plane with this Scarface guy like for the entire flight while I'm sitting in the back with this guy trying to sleep with this guy with the man bun or whatever he had. It's
Does
just
he go
a,
from that to Affliction?
No, from he, Comfort of Strangers to Sleeper.
Light Sleeper. Yeah. That's right. So Light Sleeper is the sort of bridge to Affliction.
And then you got Touch after Light Sleeper as well as the TV
movie
Touch. Witch Hunt.
And they never
Witch
saw Hunt.
Witch Hunt is...
HBO flick.
I never saw it, but it's kind of like... what was that movie that came out last year? Bright?
Yeah, where it's film noir with magic.
Yeah, exactly. Oh. And there's like... It's like Dennis Hopper is a cop and he's running around L.A.
And?
It's set in the past, though. But there's, you know,
worth
magic
watching?
And
Hollywood
fantasy.
Golden Age, if magic were being used by the criminal underworld.
Exactly.
Wow, that sounds fucking great. That sounds like better than anything that I that even associated. Wow, really?
Dennis Hopper.
I'm not, and yeah, that sounds
Is
really
it
great.
And worth watching, though? I mean,
I haven't seen it.
Oh, okay.
It is of its time.
You saw it, James?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, it's not good enough to change one's opinion about Paul Schrader.
Okay.
Nor is it bad enough to destroy your opinion of Paul Schrader.
Yeah.
It's middling.
Sounds like an HBO TV series they should do now.
Right.
That setting.
It should be an ongoing series. That would be killer.
I think there was more than one, too, right? There might have been a sequel or a second part to it that Schrader wasn't involved in.
That I don't know.
Okay. But something I was going to mention on Comfort and Strangers, we mentioned, you know, Tarantino probably saw Ving Rhames, you know, in Patty Hearst. It also seemed like he probably saw Comfort of Strangers because Walken
so
does
tight,
a lot
though.
Of the same kind of, the same, you know, the watch monologue in Pulp Fiction.
Yeah.
Seems exactly like something that would be.
Isn't that right on top of each other, though?
No, it's three or four years later.
Two?
Yeah.
Wait,
and it's
no,
just like
what year is Pulp Fiction?
94?
94. Yeah. You're right.
So just this notion of like Christopher Walken staring to a camera and doing a 3-minute monologue.
Right.
You know.
And then punching you in the back.
Yeah, exactly. That's like something that was.
Yeah, but it's so ham-fisted.
It's bad.
It just
the watch monologue's a lot better than anything
than
in.
Than my father.
Yeah.
Well, my father was.
But he's doing the same thing in Covered as Strangers. Know. It's like he's
really. But
he's really
supposed to be an Italian.
He's like an Englishman, but he's you know, living in Italy
in
with
villa,
Helen Mirren, and they just almost
right
out of
the,
nowhere
the canal.
Just decide to like rape slash murder.
Yeah,
yeah.
This dude at the end. I mean, I was like just scratching my head, like what? Like y'all didn't establish.
It works on the page,
anything.
Probably.
Yeah,
as it like kind of you know,
Light Sleeper was the first movie I ever saw at the Angelica, which is a theater that is right down the street.
Three blocks away.
And it was the first time I ever went to Angelica in 1992.
Wow.
And saw Light Sleeper.
Can I ask you a question? Since you brought up going to the movies and seeing a Schrader film, does anybody remember their first going to the seeing his movie in a movie theater? Which one was the first?
My first set. He directed that I saw in the theater.
That I saw in the theater, but I had seen like half a dozen on video beforehand.
No. But I'm wondering what your first Schrader.
The first one I saw in the theater for sure.
Mine was
I'm going to beat you all. What's that?
Light Sleeper. You probably did. You see Cat People?
Dude,
you saw Blue Collar.
Hardcore.
I
went into the movie. What year was that again?
79.
79. I was a teenager. It was playing in my neighborhood. I went to see Hardcore in the movie theater. I remember really liking it at the time. And I do still like it. And then saw Mishima in the movie theater. Remember going to that. I saw, let's see what else. Cat People in the movie theater. When it came out.
I actually saw Raging Bull in the theaters as
Me too.
A 9-year old.
I was at this.
You know.
I was at the New York premiere of that.
Oh wow, yeah.
Because my dad
but I wasn't counting
to.
That. I mean, are we counting just the ones he directed?
No.
I saw Raging Bull in the theater then.
All right,
that'd be my first one.
Yeah, okay. That works. I think if you saw Taxi
Driver.
I don't know anybody.
We're all too young to see Taxi Driver. We haven't mentioned yet. And it's an important one.
Bring it up.
Mosquito Coast.
Wait, he wrote that?
He wrote
it. Oh, yeah.
I saw that in the movie theater, too.
Yeah.
I think. Maybe not.
So he wrote that based on the novel.
Right. By Paul Theroux.
A good novel, but it differs quite a bit from the movie. Mm-hmm. I mean, not really, but it differs.
Harrison Ford doing a dramatic role, stepping away from all the franchises that he was doing.
Yeah, he tried to do that throughout the 80s.
He was
that
might have
been one of the first ones.
There.
No?
Yeah.
I mean, he started off, of course, as one of these guys working with Coppola.
And then he did. But that way, he really went over in the deep end.
And don't forget the Cisco Kid with...
With Gene Wilder.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, of course.
But
the Cisco
who could
Kid?
Forget that
I,
performance?
I'm unfamiliar with
that. That is a movie where Harrison Ford is a cowboy who teams up with Gene Wilder.
As a
like
rabbi.
Rabbi
in cowboy.
In the West. Yeah. In the Wild West.
Soul
like
American.
Rabbi.
Yeah,
it's basically so like the Jackie Chan, Owen Wilson movie.
But with Light Sleeper, when you saw in the theater, did it have a big impact on you? Because I feel like Taxi Driver is kind of like the ultimate New York underworld movie in a lot of ways for the 70s. Light Sleeper obviously is not as famous as say like a movie like say King of New York or something like that, but was it kind of an intoxicating experience?
It was for me. I was at the totally right age. You know, I saw it, you know, I think I was freshman or something like that in college, and it was just like, whoa. And
Light Sleepers also suffers from a little bit of pretentiousness.
Yeah,
but,
totally.
But the biggest flaw for me for Light Sleeper, whereas a voiceover worked really well with Taxi Driver.
Yeah.
I don't feel like Willem Dafoe's voiceover works for Light Sleeper. I think they could have just eliminated that and had a better film.
It's also so written, you know, it's like he's a drug dealer
and he's keeping a diary, a journal. Yeah.
And then when he gets to the last page, he throws it in the trash and starts a new one.
Right.
You know, it's ridiculous.
It's so ridiculous.
But I like Susan Sarandon.
I like Susan Sarandon in it too.
She's got this kind of cool
New York
vibe. He made her look
great
too. Yeah.
It deals with a lot of, Victor Garber plays this like Nazi, you know, drug user. That's pretty cool.
You got like a 16-year-old.
Well, he's more
there.
He's more like Dieter than he is. Was I mentioning that?
That this year, Willem Dafoe is up against Sam Rockwell for Best Oscar.
And they both were in
a scene together.
I think he's ridiculous.
He's like the evil Nazi.
You know, Hugo Tilson. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Really, like, if you also look, he has, like, really, really good casts in his movies.
Very
and they often are not as good as what you would think or what you'd expect. And that's going back to, yes, Blue Collar is good. But, like, if you would imagine a movie with, you know, those three actors and the guy who wrote, I don't know, you might.
Sometimes
Blue Collar succeeds, though. But you know, everybody has their opinion about it.
He has really good casts. Like, he definitely, and the people he works with behind the scenes are quite good, too.
Light Sleeper was, when it came out, a lot of people were like, oh, this is the unofficial sequel of Taxi Driver. If Travis Bickle didn't die, what would he be, you know, 20 years later? Mm-hmm. And he'd be this drug dealer who knew New York really and is still having trouble. And, you know, he's an ex-addict. And that was kind
of how
it was
pitched. But Schrader himself would often say this is a bookend to that film, like he did it also with The Walker, which we didn't talk about, which is a very mediocre film. I mean,
wait, is that just the Walker, the one with
Woody Harrelson Lily Tomlin?
The Alex Cox
one is the one I'm thinking of.
Kristen Scott Thomas
and Lily Tomlin, yep. And of course Lauren Bacall. It's just a terrible movie.
I couldn't finish it.
It's really unwatchable. Yeah.
Wait, was Schrader involved with Last Temptation of Christ?
Yes, he wrote it.
He wrote it.
And so, apparently there's a bit of a rivalry between him and Scorsese, where basically he said, look, either you make this movie or I'm going to make it. And Scorsese said, got the pride for my cold, dead hands. But for a while, there were a lot of directors who really wanted to bring that movie.
Oh, I thought Scorsese, that was like his first dream project for decades.
Yeah, and then it was silent.
And then he couldn't make it because of the flop of New York. And then he decided to make
After Hours,
which was, you know, obviously a hit. And then he was allowed to make Raging... I'm getting it all confused, the timeline, but he, you know...
Color of Money?
Color of Money, exactly. But then he would go back and forth, in favor with the studios. Obviously, the King of Comedy was also another flop, and, you know...
I mean, I think Last Temptation of Christ, I mean, you should actually do a Wrong Real episode of Jesus movies, and I would be happy to come on that.
I've actually got a Jesus episode planned. Leanne Kubitz is coming on for Easter to do Jesus Christ Superstar, as well as April Fool's Day, because it falls on April Fool's Day this year, so we're going to do a little double feature.
Oh, okay. Last Temptation of Christ is, I think, a pretty good Jesus movie.
Me too.
As they go.
Yeah, I think so.
I think it's Harvey Keitel's among his worst casting, like that in The Duelist.
Easily Harvey Keitel's worst haircut in the history
of
his career.
Like Harvey Keitel as Judas is Judas Iscariot, you know, but I think it's actually a pretty good Jesus movie, and I think the Jesus movies are a genre as they go. There's been a good like dozen or so of them.
If anybody can go from Judas to being a Maori.
Yeah.
That's right.
It's only Harvey Keitel.
It's the last Schrader Scorsese collaboration, Bringing Out the Dead.
Yes.
Yes.
Which is bad.
But next year, or later this year, whenever it is, we're going to have the Irish.
I saw Bringing Out the
Dead.
And
that's a Schrader script?
Do you remember?
Oh, no, I'm sorry.
It might be.
There was a theater on 42nd Street, I think. That was the second best theater after the one over here on 57.
That was the Astor.
Yeah. And I actually saw Bringing Out the Dead in like such an empty theater that we were smoking pot in the theater during the movie.
I saw opening weekend at the Chinese theater in L.A. and I don't think there were more than 10 people there. Yeah. I was like.
It was bad, but it wasn't. It wasn't that bad.
Like people were running up and going
behind.
Cool
look.
I haven't seen it since.
It's like Nick Cage is an ambulance driver.
I remember
it's like dark.
I remember all the club scenes. I was like, this feels like a movie made by old people who are totally don't get what it's like to be like. Club scene of the late 90s.
I thought that one had some really nice chemistry with Nicolas Cage and Patricia Arquette. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure if they were still married or if they were like exes at that point, but they had some really good chemistry.
Yeah.
That's like a mess. And I just think when you sort of pile up these,
you're coming back again.
Messes,
what about, I know, they speak,
well,
they
hey,
speak,
I said he did a good
they
Jesus
speak volumes.
Movie.
No, you've been very complimentary. And I just, but you know, the,
Jesus movies are tough,
but I think you see that his messes bring, you know, like they're mostly messes and they kind of every so often by almost sheer luck bring a solid film. And I do want to say Autofocus is an example because it's watched it again last night.
Autofocus is great.
I thought it was better this time than the first time I saw it. Like I think Willem Dafoe, hands down, you know,
Willem Dafoe's
I think
great
he's
in
so
it.
Good in it and he's so it's like the king, it's like it's
sleazy,
like it's like Rupert Pupkin, like uncomfortable.
There as well.
It's mostly there.
He's massaging himself when he's on the phone with his friend at the end. I'm like,
yeah,
good cast.
Yeah, really good cast, and it captured the. I mean, it didn't have the budget of something like the Leonardo DiCaprio, Tom Hanks, Steven Spielberg movie.
Catch Me If You Can.
Yeah, which I think is actually the last great Spielberg movie. Like, mm-hmm. For me, I don't think he's done much since then that, you know, and I'm not expecting much
Munich?
From him.
Was that before that?
Yeah, I mean, Munich.
It was before Munich.
And Munich also, if you've seen, Munich is like a remake of a movie with Stephen Bauer. That movie had already been made.
Okay.
And it's actually got like the same sort of... Anyway, getting back to it, I think, Autofocus does capture that sort of, you know, 60s to 70s vibe the way Mad Men does, the way why do I always forget the name of it? What's the Spielberg movie? Catch Me If You Can.
Yeah. It's a forgettable title.
Yeah.
I mean, somewhat. It's very conversational.
You know? And I think Catch Me If You Can is better, but I think Autofocus is really good. Autofocus is absolutely one of his best movies.
Yeah, and it's also in keeping with all these themes. It's about deviance. It's about...
And it's also about this thing, sort of like the Patty Hearst thing, but I think he does a much better job with the Bob Crane story than they do with the Patty Hearst thing. And again, you've got the Bob Crane is almost him, you know, this like sort of good guy who's got this porn addiction and, you know.
Yeah.
And treats women like shit. Yeah. I don't know. Autofocus is really good. So you don't like Affliction, or you think?
Well, I didn't think it stood up to the test of time. I think that when I went to see it in the movies when it came out, I really liked it a lot. And when I watched it again the other day, I just felt like it was a little obvious.
Yeah,
and it didn't. It wasn't pretentious, but it was like almost like the opposite direction. Where
these movies about like the destructive power of alcoholism can be very problematic, and I bet the book was better.
Yeah,
it's like a Russell Banks book.
It's a Russell Banks.
Yeah. And the voiceover again, Willem Dafoe's voiceover spoils a lot of it for me because he's also
like
keeping
brother. Of
yeah,
he's the brother, and in the book it really works well as a device, but they should have stripped it out for the movie. I think I read the book. I'm only remembering it now. You know, in discussion, because I remember it.
It's been 20 years.
That fits in again with this theme. I mean, so stylistically, he doesn't necessarily have any kind of, you know, consistency, but these themes of like the self-destructive guy, whether it's like drugs or alcohol or pornography or sex or whatever, and the inability to connect, you know.
But also,
like,
they're not purely cautionary tales, because I feel like the Greg Kinnear character, he's very... he defends the fact that he thinks sex is very normal and people shouldn't be ashamed. And it's like, I don't think it's ever... The movies aren't completely black and white, like drugs are bad, sex is bad, all this stuff is bad. Because there's an intoxicating element to these movies as well, which excites your curiosity. Maybe that's depends upon your own individual experiences coming into it, but these movies don't entirely terrify me. In a lot of ways, they kind of beckon me in to explore some of this stuff.
With Autofocus, I think it's very... I mean, this just occurred to me. You know, the connection between sex and technology in Autofocus, how their whole sort of sex thing is brought by the video, by the video camera and the VCR.
Yeah.
And then there are like these various things that, oh, I can edit it. Oh, I can do this. Oh, I can do that. Very much speaks to like today. I mean, Dildonics is supposed to make its really big premiere in 2018.
Explain.
And that's where like you have like a device and it's hooked up with your computer. And so when the adult actress's muscles clench, this thing clenches. When you thrust, it thrusts. Like there's a whole
sounds
thing.
Sounds like a pot trainer.
But no, but there's all, you know, the sex robots are getting more and more. And I'm just saying, you know, like the reality is that the VHS beat Beta because Sony refused to get involved with the porn companies and VHS did.
Laser
sex and technology. Uh-huh. You know, most of what's on the internet is sex. You know, I mean, sex and technology are so related in our culture.
The one
and
exception,
I think,
bound. I was going to say something.
But usually sex determines format wars, but with the HD DVD versus Blu-ray, even though the porn industry embraced HD DVD, in this case, it was the one time where the sex industry did not prevail over the rival technology.
Is that because of video games, though? Because the Blu-ray thing was the PlayStation?
Sony,
it could very well be.
And also, I don't even think Blu-ray won that battle.
Yeah, because the war, there was nothing left to fight over.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly
charred
right.
Charred remains that nobody cared about.
Yeah, I've maybe bought 1,000 DVDs in my life. I've maybe bought 10 or 15 Blu-rays.
It's really sad, isn't it, that this whole format like never really...
Well, but that's also because, you know, I didn't look in the folder with all this stuff because I was able to find like between... Netflix and Amazon and HBO.
Don't offer incriminating evidence about Jeremy Workman.
Well, no, but I was able to find like 9 or 10 Paul Schrader movies. You know what I mean?
Sure.
Like across the just streaming. I mean, it's true. I have a lot more Blu-rays than you, but I regret it because it's like, I mean, I've got Criterion Blu-rays that I bought like 5 years ago that I haven't watched.
So we live in New York. Space comes at a premium. I'm not going to collect a bunch of physical media. I'm trying to get rid of physical media, not add to the library. So.
Me too.
Are you?
Oh, 100%. If I could put my entire library on an iPad, I would.
We should.
Well, that's what I do. All my movies are now, you know, stored in the cloud.
We should get a whole little thing together of all the different films.
Oh, the Malone boxes I'm keeping. I collected physical comics from 1979 to 2011, and I will keep the long boxes.
Right.
So, yeah.
Where are
Chico,
those?
Chico, you've dumped so much of your collections.
I have.
Laserdiscs.
I have, and I still have a lot to go. And I'm the asshole who had like Laserdiscs, then DVDs. Like, there are movies that I owned on VHS, on Laserdisc, on DVD, on Blu-ray. Like, this industry, I don't know it anything.
Yeah, you can't buy your
collection. I don't know the movies.
I had a Laserdisc collection. I had a DVD collection. I had a VHS collection. I'm not buying a fourth collection.
No, exactly. Yeah. And, you know.
Sorry, we're talking format wars.
We got a little sidetracked. Yeah,
no, it's perfectly understandable. I was running the water.
We're up to what? We're up to
like kind of like, 21st century.
I mean,
I do want to say well, we could talk about the canyons, I suppose.
I'm a fan.
It was okay, but
I'm a big fan, actually.
And the trailer is outrageously good.
Yeah. The article, the New York Times article about it is like
the
magazine piece of media.
The New York Times article.
A 10,000-word article.
Yeah, it was amazing.
It was amazing.
The movie cannot.
It was called "This Is What Happens When You Cast Lindsay Lohan."
Right.
Okay, tell me something. Do you really like movies? But really, really like movies. When's the last time you went to see a movie in a theater? You know, a movie that you really thought meant something to you. I don't know. You know, I guess maybe it's just not my thing anymore.
I like making my own movies.
What do you mean you make your own movies?
I guess I'd like to keep some parts of my life private.
Nobody has a private life anymore, Tara.
All actors, aren't we?
There are descriptions in there of like him coaching her to get naked, and she's in a closet, and he's naked outside the closet trying to get her to come out. Just imagining like a 67-year-old naked Paul Schrader and
I do
naked
most
Lindsay
evenings
Lohan, and
right
she's
this
been
time.
Like a sex worker for like a decade now, and you know, it's just the whole thing is so weird.
It is,
or allegedly she's been a sex worker for a decade now.
But it's interesting. Lindsay Lohan's been a sex worker for less.
Yeah,
than
no, the she character. She can't even get insured for movies, and so she owes drug dealers.
There's
so
even
much
a joke
money
about that. Sacha Baron Cohen movie. She's like,
oh yeah, no,
Ruby? Like, what am I, a Kardashian?
She's one of these. Yeah. She's one of these like yacht girls in like Cannes, and like, you know, with really wealthy like dudes that like, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of actresses who once they run out of getting work, they do that with
really.
Yeah, yeah. So it's called, like, on the internet, like in the gossip, it's called yachting. Like, it's a whole thing, and they'll be like,
"Thank you for bringing
this." She was yachting this season.
Wow.
Wait a minute. I know that. Don't insult my intelligence.
I think you just pitched my next case.
Like Yasmin Bleeth and like Pamela Anderson and
which one's Yasmin
Bleeth? Misha Barton. Like all these actresses.
I remember Yasmin Bleeth.
Big 90s actress.
Basically, anytime you see an actress at Cannes and she doesn't have a movie there. She's going there to get on yachts with really wealthy, like Middle Eastern
dudes. Who was the woman in the 70s into the 80s?
Kelly LeBrock?
No, not Kelly LeBrock. She's very petite, but kind of curvaceous, like
Mary Lou Retton.
Generic European. Like, had the name Pia Zadora or something? Is that her name?
Yeah, Pia Zadora.
Was it? She might have been one of the first yacht girls. Then,
because
that's what she did.
I'm sure
it goes back to like Brigitte Bardot.
Yeah. Brigitte Bardot.
You know, Marilyn Monroe was like trading sex for meatballs and stuff like that.
I'm not ready to throw Marilyn under the bus.
Yeah.
I mean, one thing I will say is Lindsay Lohan has apparently converted to Islam, so I don't know how that is working with her.
Well,
with her yachting career, but she has. I mean,
she's very good in the canyons.
Yeah,
and she does help bring Schrader's kind of brings it not full circle. It brings the sex you know, you get to see a quite a trajectory there from the late 70s to the whatever.
And James Dean is very good.
Is really good in
like,
that movie.
I would actually argue, you know, he had a Me Too movement before the Me Too thing started, where a lot of porn stars accused him of
a complete, total, violent human being.
Right. Yeah, so, but what I was going to say is, I think he could have had that not happen. He could have had a career.
Oh, I see.
I mean, you know, but that doesn't Tom Sizemore molests 7-year-old girls on sets, and nobody seems to have a problem with it.
Well, there's a lot of people. Well, there's a lot of people are expressing problems with a lot of these guys now.
I know, James Dean could have had a career.
He's very good.
He's quite good, yeah. And you know, he has a real following. He's probably the most well-known male, you know, porn star. Mm-hmm. And, you know, again,
certainly of the 21st century.
Like, Sasha Gray really was fizzled out, and Tracy Lords didn't totally work. Like, they've been trying to break, like, porn stars for a long time.
Although Sasha Gray made so much money in such a short period of time. I've listened to some interviews with her, and she's insanely intelligent. Like,
she's very smart.
That will catch you off guard. But she talks about, hey, she made all this money in porn, and now she writes indie dramas. And she's almost kind of laughed at the fact that she writes indie dramas now. But I think she just enjoying the fact that she has the freedom now to explore an independent film career without the fear of not being able to pay your bills, etc.
Well, she did it right. I mean, the way that she was able to come out right in her head. I mean, like, basically she did all her porn at the age of 18, and then it got released over the next 4 years. And then she announced she was retired, but she had already been retired for like 3 years.
Oh, well.
I did the Girlfriend Experience trailer.
Interesting.
Thanks for that.
Did you meet her?
That's definitely her best.
I was invited to a party for its premiere, and she was there, yeah.
I think she was better on on Entourage than she was in The Girl. I didn't think she was good in The Girlfriend. I thought she ruined the movie.
Like, James Dean is way better than she
is.
Right,
that's my point. James Dean is better than any of these women actors in the Schrader movie. And, you know, no one's ever – Lindsay Lohan is actually a good – I mean, that's what the whole thing is that she's actually good.
What are her antics that get her into trouble on movies like The Canyons?
Well, she was already at the point where she couldn't get insurance. And that's the thing that killed –
She doesn't show up.
She didn't show up. She can't get work.
She has a huge cocaine habit. She's, like, in hock to mobsters. She shows up, you know, totally hungover.
Who would hire her if mobsters are going to come to the set to collect,
right,
you know, on her death?
Or she can't come because she's hiding from them.
Right. Paul Schrader in a $250,000 movie.
Right.
Yeah.
It's pretty amazing, though, like, even that Paul Schrader and what's-his-face?
Bret Easton Ellis.
Bret Easton Ellis.
Yeah, you know.
Who?
Bret Easton Ellis
wrote it.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Less Than Zero.
Yeah, he's got a podcast.
Lindsay Lohan is talented. She's just squandered it.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's a set.
Like,
it's set.
Yeah.
It's gone beyond the tabloid to really... It's just
she's gotten plastic surgery. I think she's had the plastic surgery before The Canyons because she looks really weird. She looks really weird. It does capture that same cold L.A., which turns me off in that you have in American Gigolo. I was introduced to L.A. as a New Yorker who never went to L.A. until... I've only been to L.A. once, and I was like 26. But like...
So you just were there.
Yeah. No, the... Repo Man was my introduction to L.A. And like, I had seen Repo Man like for like things like Repo Man and like, you know, what's the freaking movie where
To Live and Die in L.A.
Movies that like
Willem Dafoe.
Yeah, but Repo Man is what was my like understanding of L.A.
What's A Million Ways to Die?
Roseanne Arquette, I know, plays a sex worker in it.
Okay.
Yeah.
But it's with what's his face?
Tom Selleck?
No, it's with
Tom
like
Selleck.
You know, the dude who was in Kiss the Spider Woman and
Raul Julia?
William Hurt.
No,
William Hurt.
Hurt, yeah.
William Hurt.
Isn't William Hurt in that in To Live and Die in L.A.? No.
No.
Eight Million Ways to Die.
And 8 Million Ways to Die was actually based it was based on a series of pulp books. It was like, you know, one of, and if it had been more successful, they would have made more.
Okay.
It was like, you know.
But coming back to the Canyons for a second, I'm from L.A.
Yes.
I grew up in L.A. I grew up in mountains above Malibu. That's where the Canyons is set. Corrosive.
Looking down at it.
Yeah,
like
I mean, I feel like that movie like nails that.
Oh, sure. I'm not saying it doesn't
the
have
verisimilitude,
the aesthetic, but it's an aesthetic that turns me
off. It's corrosive L.A. thing.
Whereas if it was like 1971 Laurel Canyon and it was like, you know, based on like Stephen Stills meeting Joni Mitchell or something like that, I'd probably be a little more into it.
Right. Right.
Yeah. But
that aughts.
But they were doing a lot of cocaine then too.
I mean,
that's true.
So, you know, this is interestingly timed. I don't think I put this together in my head until after I already pitched it for us, that Paul Schrader does in fact have a brand new movie, as we mentioned at the beginning, called First Reformed, which comes back again to the religion and possibly redemption theme. I don't know quite, but it stars Ethan Hawke and what's her name?
Amanda
Seyfried.
Yeah.
Right? So
fresh off of being Linda Lovelace.
Well,
she lives nearby here. I've seen her in Washington Square Park a few times with this giant.
So
is
it similar? So is he continuing to follow Scorsese, who had his movie Silence about religion and something? And I couldn't tell you what that movie's supposed to be.
I have not watched that one either.
That's a pile of silliness.
Silence has its defenders.
It looks a lot like The Mission to me.
Without the Ennio Morricone soundtrack. But yes.
Yeah, so, I mean, I'm going to see this movie.
You're going to see the Schrader movie?
Oh, yeah.
Well,
yeah,
we
sure.
should just mention Dog Eat Dog, which is based on an Edward Bunker novel, and Edward Bunker was in Reservoir Dogs, and he is the character that John Voight is based on.
Mr. Blue,
on.
Right?
Yeah, he's Mr. Blue, and John Voight's character is completely based on him in Heat. Like, that's who John Voight is. Like, he's
disfigured in that one, right?
Well, he sold score, like, his hairdo and his, I think he's very pockmarked.
Right.
But Animal Factory was a movie with Willem Dafoe and Eddie Furlong that is based on Straight Time by Ulu Grosbard, which is my favorite of Dustin Hoffman.
Which is very Schrader.
It is, but it's better than most of the Schrader movies. But anyway, I was going to say, like, Schrader also now has the honor of, like, there have been, like, 4 movies based on Edward Bunker books, and he has the worst one.
I would watch any movie by Paul Schrader that he cares to make. There are plenty of them that I think are borderline beneath contempt, but even the messes. I love movies that are spectacular messes because there's usually like a scene or a detail or an element that you can't take your eyes off of, and I feel like Schrader always has that potential to show something we've never seen before, and I like the fact that he explores all these dark, forbidden themes, and it does seem like he always, while he might return to certain themes, it does seem like he's always trying to explore the dark side of humanity in ways that other filmmakers just will not do, and so...
And he's probably, thank you for saying that, it's a good place to kind of wind down. I think he's really had to take, a certain number of blows for that, for those choices. I mean, I think he could have gone far more commercial when he had a certain amount of prestige and strength, or power rather, in the industry.
He could have gone the Tony Scout route or something like that.
I suppose he could have taken, various
points
in his
career. I
would say the
average Tony Scott movie is way better than the average.
But he's already in bed with Bruckheimer.
He's not making the movies that Bruckheimer...
He could have made Risk to Make.
That's right.
Blade Runner.
Right.
As entertaining as Blade Runner 2049 is...
my second favorite movie of last year.
I enjoyed it, but it was basically
I was fascinated, but I wasn't as entertained.
No, but I'm just saying it kind of just pushed all the right buttons. It was made solidly. It did what it did for the nostalgic, crowd, much the way the Star Wars rebooting,
Also about sex and technology, I would just point out, a lot autofocus. Autofocus and Blade Runner 2049 is a good double feature.
Well said. Thank you, guys.
Yeah.
I hope that people will be able to enjoy this episode as much as I did. And
lots of caffeine and alcohol before.
There's
a lot of
bantering going on, but great stuff. And I'm hoping also to use this as a possible way to maybe dangle in front of Schrader's people as a way of saying, "Look, we just did this great tribute to."
Chickalita just to torpedo that.
Yes, I'll hold you responsible personally. You're going to owe me big time for sabotaging my efforts here. No, not at all. I don't expect them to listen to it. Anyway, so hopefully maybe Schrader will come on and then we'll push play.
He's a good talker. I've never read an interview where he wasn't anything short of absolutely fascinating. He can talk his ass off.
And he doesn't pull punches either.
Right.
According to
Aaron West, he's doing something with the Criterion Cast podcast.
Interesting. Very cool.
He also has is he in movies besides his own? Like, he's in Dog Eat Dog. Like, I've seen him make cameos. He actually has a pretty big role in Dog Eat Dog, and I've seen him in other things.
I have to watch it again.
He's no Sidney Pollack, but he actually could have an acting career. Or the other one is what's his face? Who you guys did the whole episode on the wrong reel? Albert Brooks also.
Yeah. Oh my god!
Another director who's like managed to eke out an acting.
Oh yeah,
career.
There's a few, quite a few sure. though, that that
well, Finding Nemo will pay a lot of bills.
That's true, but I actually think Sydney Pollack's three appearances
Pollack was good. Mazursky was good in movies.
Oh, right.
Yeah,
Mazursky.
So I you know, but
Bogdanovich has done a lot of acting.
Yes, well that's all. Yeah, including right. in a film that Jeremy Workman directed that right, both yeah. me and Peter Bogdanovich appear in. We both play filmmakers in that movie.
It is true.
That is what? True. And he got bigger billing. Billing than I did, and it's still a sore point to this day.
All right,
moving on.
Yes.
I want to thank James Hancock again. Check out Wrong Reel. It's very easy to find on the interwebs, right? And Jeremy Workman, and good luck. I look forward to being at your premiere.
Thank you.
For The World Before
The World before Your Feet.
Your Feet, mm-hmm. about Matt Green. Mm-hmm. And Chico, Leo, we're going to get you back online.
Yeah, I'm going to be back on back podcasting again from my, you know.
Well,
from,
use this time well.
Yes. Well, you can find me, The Chico Leo, at Twitter.
Yeah.
I mostly retweet stuff that's interesting, but occasionally I, you know, get
You were around. Retweeting some Thank cool you. Comic stuff earlier.
Yeah.
Today.
Yeah.
Thank you all, by the way, for supporting my Kickstarter, too.
Sure. Oh, yeah. Right. And speaking of which, yes, yeah. exactly. I'm looking for my poster.
I know.
Thanks for the mad loops.
You got it, but we'll get it autographed.
Okay, cool.
We'll figure something out for you to make up for the lateness. Thank you, guys.
Awesome. Thank
Thanks.
You.
Broken lines, broken strings.